Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 208. It's Monday, April 24th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start big and hang on because it's going to get even bigger. First up, from Common Dreams, policy murder. Research shows poverty is fourth leading cause of death in U.S. Research published last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated that poverty was linked to at least 183,000 deaths in the United States in 2019 among people aged 15 and older, making inadequate income the nation's fourth leading mortality driver behind heart disease, cancer, and smoking. Poverty kills as much as dementia, accidents, stroke, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, said David Brady, a professor of public policy at the University of California and lead author of the new analysis. I would offer one small editorial correction. In public health, we generally don't refer to accidents. We believe there's reasons for things. We call them injuries. Poverty silently killed 10 times as many people as all homicides in 2019, Brady continued. And yet, homicide, firearms, and suicide get vastly more attention. The Reverend Dr. William Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, wrote that the research underlies the importance of connecting extremist inaction on gun violence to other forms of policy murder. The new analysis, co-authored by Ulrich Kohler of the University of Potsdam in Germany and Huo Zhang of Ohio State University, stressed that the U.S. perennially has a far higher poverty rate than peer-rich democracies, which presents an enormous challenge to population health given that considerable research demonstrates that being in poverty is bad for one's health. Poverty, which the study defined as less than half the median U.S. income, was associated with greater mortality than many more visible causes in 2019. 10 times as many deaths as homicide, 4.7 times as many deaths as firearms, 3.9 times as many deaths as suicide, and 2.6 times as many deaths as drug overdose. Now, I will note that usually when I report on poverty, and most people use the federal definition, they're using half of the median U.S. income as a definition of poverty, which is a much broader, probably includes about twice the income. But actually, if you're looking at people with strained resources that, quote, near poor, it's probably not a bad way to look at it. And actually, you're including a larger part of the population that has these 10 times, 5 times, 3 times greater risks of things like homicide and suicide and drug overdose. Because the U.S. consistently has high poverty rates, these estimates contribute to understanding why the U.S. has comparatively lower life expectancy. The researchers argued their results indicate that poverty should be considered a major risk factor for death in the U.S., which has seen life expectancy decline since 2015. And fall sharply amid the coronavirus pandemic. The mortality associated with poverty is also associated with enormous economic costs, they continued. Therefore, benefit cost calculations of poverty-reducing social policies should incorporate the benefits of lower mortality. Moreover, poverty likely aggravated the mortality impact of COVID-19, which occurred after our analyses ended in 2019. Therefore, one limitation of this study is that our estimates may be conservative about the number of deaths associated with poverty. The onset of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020 brought about a sharp increase in U.S. poverty as millions of people got sick, were thrown out of work, and lost health insurance. But federal aid initiatives enacted in response to the public health and economic crisis, from stimulus checks to boosted unemployment benefits to enhanced nutrition assistance, ultimately led to a significant drop in poverty, further bolstering the case that poverty is a policy choice. However, many of these poverty-reducing aid programs, including an enhanced child tax credit that sharply slashed poverty among kids in the U.S., have since lapsed or been terminated, threatening to reverse any recent progress. Brady said in a statement that if the U.S. had less poverty, there'd be a lot better health and well-being, people could work more, and they could be more productive. All of those, he added, are benefits of investing in people through social policies. So this is a very important article, and it does get to the difficulty in epidemiology of, you know, ascertaining causes and effects, leading causes of death and such. So I've said for a long time that smoking is the single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S., which is true, but smoking is never listed as a cause of death. It's mostly heart disease and cancer that would drive the smoking deaths. So in the same case, when they're talking about poverty, they're approaching it as an upstream kind of cause, like smoking causes downstream deaths of cardiovascular and cancer, poverty causes these other causes of death. So that's why they're sort of mixing, not quite apples and oranges, but heart disease, cancer, and smoking, and then poverty following those. Okay, well, time to get even bigger. I wanted to reference this larger article that's worth reading. I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning of the end just to kind of make a point, and you'd be happy. I'd be happy to have you go to the website and read the full article. And as I do my bonus articles at the end, I'll give you the link for where you can go for that. This is from the Taiyi. The rising chorus of renewable energy skeptics. We are going to have to dramatically downsize the dream of a future in which we replace 150-year-old fossil fuel infrastructure with so-called clean energy by 2050. That's the message in a number of recent important reports and books. They underscore a number of problems with the renewables illusion, including the complexity of the task, the toxicity of rare earth mining, and the scarcity of critical minerals. There are dramatic limits to growth, and the world needs a better plan to avoid collapse other than replacing one unsustainable fossil fuel system with another intensive mining system powered by even more extreme energies. In other words, electrifying the Titanic won't melt the icebergs in its path. So this is going really big as far as looking at the basic assumptions that we have underlying Western culture. You know, growth. And the fact that we may be able to switch, for instance, to like electric vehicles, but the minerals that are required to make the batteries and the rest of the car themselves are a lot more resource intensive as far as minerals and such, and actually the energy it takes to produce them, mine them, that type of thing, and the toxicity of these minerals all the way from mining through production and disposal. You know, the fact that they get spread all over the earth. Like, for instance, as an example, mercury. Mercury is spread in very small amounts throughout the earth crust, but the fact that we've collected all together, then strewn it all about, has exposed us to massive more amounts of mercury, which is extremely dangerous, as an example. But the bottom line of this article is that we need to do something far more approaching a simple living approach with far less consumption, and something that is truly sustainable, not merely kicking the can down the road for future generations. Okay, and another article that similarly goes big, but this time switches to mental health, this from Mad in America, The Hidden Injuries of Oppression. And I'm just going to read one of the intro articles and one of the closing article just to get at the gist of this, but there's a lot more included in this article. As a rule, mainstream psychiatry and psychology situate the causes of problems within the individuals impacted. Then subsequent treatment focuses solely on this level. However, there's a far more powerful force at work behind these harmful events. Omission of the role played by this cause is not due to ignorance or simple misunderstanding. Rather, its impact is intentionally obfuscated and denied by psychiatrists and psychologists who perpetuate a restrictive view of the nature of human suffering, in which those afflicted are abstracted from the larger context they are inextricably embedded in. In doing so, they not only benefit from this neglect, but actually contribute even further by suffering they profess to seek to alleviate. That missing cause is systemic oppression. So this is a theme actually from this website, Mad in America, a theme that runs through their work, going big as far as the larger upstream things that modern psychiatry and psychology tends to focus what's, you know, kind of between the ears in the skull as the cause of mental illness, rather than looking at the profound forces in society, namely systemic oppression, that create trauma and stress in our society. Okay, the last paragraph of this article. Instead of focusing solely on internal causes of their suffering, we must cast a wider net. We might reflect with these individuals on the question, is this the kind of society in which you wish to live or that you want for those you love? And then follow this with, how do you imagine we might be able to create a better one? For as social beings, we are not in this situation alone. We are all afflicted in some way by oppression. We also in some ways contribute to it. And together we are all able to bring about a more just world. And of course, here at Just for the Health of It, we're trying to put just in the just for the health of it.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment, from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones, from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, sticking to the theme of going big, but drilling down a bit to an example of one of the outcomes of this from CNN. Refined carbs and red meat driving global rise in type 2 diabetes, study says. Gobbling up too many refined wheat and rice products, along with eating too few whole grains, is fueling the growth of new cases of type 2 diabetes worldwide, according to a new study that models data through 2018. Diabetes rates may surge in U.S. young people. Our study suggests poor carbohydrate quality is a leading driver of diet-attributable type 2 diabetes globally, says senior author Dr. Darish Mozafari, a professor of nutrition at Tufts University. Another key factor, people are eating far too much red and processed meat, such as bacon, sausage, salami, and the like. Those three factors, eating too few whole grains and too many processed grains and meats, were the primary drivers of over 14 million new cases of type 2 diabetes in 2018, according to the study published in the journal Nature Medicine. In fact, the study estimated 7 out of 10 cases of type 2 diabetes worldwide in 2018 were linked to poor food choices. Researchers found eating too many unhealthy foods was more of a driver of type 2 diabetes on a global level than a lack of eating wholesome foods, especially for men compared to women, younger compared to older adults, and in urban versus rural residents. So this is an interesting thing because it is generally not a bad recommendation that for making dietary changes, often just adding healthy foods to your diet, and that somehow oftentimes helps push out some of the unhealthy choices just by substitution effect. But the fact is, our diet, the standard American diet, the SAD diet, is so pervasive that it's hard to avoid, and you can't just push out the basis, the foundation of that diet, which is refined carbohydrates and a lot of red and processed meats. So you have to strike at the heart of the unhealthy base of our diet. Okay, back to the article. Over 60% of the total global diet attributable cases of diabetes were due to excess intake of just 6 harmful dietary habits: eating too much refined rice, wheat, and potatoes, too many processed and unprocessed red meats, and drinking too many sugar-sweetened beverages and fruit juice. Inadequate intake of 5 protective dietary factors: fruits, non-starchy vegetables, nuts, seeds, whole grains, and yogurt was responsible for just over 39% of the new cases. Our modeling approach does not prove causation, and our findings should be considered as estimates of risk, the authors wrote. Of course, researchers are always cautious in saying you need more research, but these trends have been well established. Okay, well, public policy and public health are partly based on the art of the possible, so I wanted to report on what Europe is doing about reducing BPA exposure, one of the environmental challenges we have. This from the Environmental Health Network. Europe seeks drastic cut to BPA exposure. BPA is about to disappear from European burger wrappers, soft drink bottles, canned food liners, and all other food packaging. A proposal being considered by European regulators finds that current BPA exposure limits vastly underestimate the harm of the plastic additives caused to human health. The revised rules say the new exposure threshold should be 20,000 times lower than today's level. If the recommendations in the new assessment released by the European Food Safety Authority, the European equivalent of the US FDA, are adopted, it would more than likely force BPA out of products that come into contact with food in Europe. This new safe level is so low that it will drive and accelerate changes in the supply chain. Marcel Maffini, an environmental consultant focused on environmental chemical exposures who has worked with the Environmental Defense Fund and others, told Environmental Health News. The new assessment and recommended daily dose is more in line with current science, which continues to find BPA impacts our health in a myriad of ways. It is also a stark contrast to U.S. regulations of the ubiquitous chemical. The U.S. safe daily exposure level for BPA, which was set in 1988, is 250,000 times higher than the new European recommendation. The new risk assessment provides scientific evidence that makes it urgent for FDA and other agencies to act to reduce the levels of exposure, Maffini said. BPA is an endocrine disruptor, meaning it alters the proper functioning of our hormones. The chemical has been linked to multiple health problems, including cancer, diabetes, obesity, reproductive, nervous, and immune system impacts, and behavioral problems. It remains a key ingredient in polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins, ending up in Tupperware, food can liners, and other food packaging. The chemical can leach out of such packaging and get into our food. Academic scientists and health advocates have for years called into question how BPA and other endocrine disruptors, such as phthalates, some flame retardants, and pesticides, are regulated. Most federal agencies subscribe to the concept that, quote, the dose makes the poison. However, for chemicals like BPA, that's not always true, and sometimes low doses and high doses can have different effects. Europe's new assessment recognizes that. The bottom line? Even the tiniest amounts of BPA in, say, the cap of a soda bottle will violate the new exposure limits. Europe says we basically shouldn't have BPA in our products at all if we don't want health impacts. After Europe recommended slashing of BPA allowable doses last year, a group of doctors, scientists, and health organizations petitioned the U.S. FDA to review the safety of BPA in food packaging. The FDA accepted the petition last summer, which means they need to complete an assessment that justifies whether they will accept the petition suggestions or not. That assessment hasn't yet been completed. The FDA is currently reviewing that BPA petition received in September 2022, and does not comment on petitions that are under review, the spokesperson said. We will publish our response to the petition in the Federal Register once we have completed our review. Unfortunately, the chemical and food industries, as among other industries, move much faster than government regulation and not able to keep up in many cases. Okay, I want to switch gears here a little and do an interesting story. This from Medical Express. Psychologists map the psyche of extreme altruists. Although many people admire the actions of people who engage in acts of extraordinary altruism, like altruistic organ donors, bone marrow donors, and heroes who rescue people from fires or accidents, they are also often mystified by what motivates these altruists to act. Published in Nature Communications, a new paper from a team of Georgetown researchers aims to answer this question by mapping out the psychological profiles of a range of extreme real-world altruists, like heroic rescuers, humanitarian aid workers, and people who donate organs or bone marrows to strangers at no benefit to themselves. But they are not different in a lot of ways. They are not more agreeable or conscientious, they are not insensitive to risk in general, and they don't even report higher levels of empathy. Instead, their choices reflect the fact that they appear to truly value the well-being of strangers and the welfare of their communities. The battery of tests revealed that extreme altruists have consistently high levels of honesty, humility, a personality trait defined by the Hexaco model of personality structure. This personality trait is marked by the tendency to be fair and genuine in dealing with others, in the sense of cooperation with others, even when one might exploit others without suffering retaliation, according to Kibium Lee and Michael Ashton, who developed the Hexaco model. People who have high levels of honesty, humility, have a low sense of self-importance and are unwilling to use, exploit, or harm others to benefit themselves. These results call attention to some common assumptions about human nature as selfish, said Sean Rhodes, the paper's first author. While self-focused motives for pro-social behaviors certainly exist, such as helping others in order to receive something in return or to improve one's reputation, these data suggests that acts of real-world sacrifice, even in extreme cases, can reflect simply unselfish motivations and preferences as well. All right, so I think about this a lot sometimes when reflecting on the causes of public health and the fact that their choices reflect the fact that they appear to truly value the well-being of strangers and the welfare of their communities. So that's kind of it, you know, being self-focused, individual-focused, or being focused on the welfare of the entire community, which, of course, most of those are strangers, whether in our own community, nation, or worldwide. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, we also have a story that has a large context. Our culture is the most drug-using, both legal and illegal, in the world, and probably world history. But this story also drills down to some of the many challenges and is a good case study for how public health can work or not work. This from Stat News. Over-the-counter naloxone is a baby step towards making the life-saving medication accessible. In an attempt to make naloxone more accessible amid the massive human toll of the opioid crisis, the FDA recently approved over-the-counter naloxone. Naloxone is the one solution that has remained constant through the evolving opioid crisis, a safe and effective medication that can quickly reverse an overdose. It is a critical tool in the public health response to the opioid crisis. Until now, naloxone availability has been a bit confusing, with each state taking a slightly different approach. Generally, harm reduction and public health organizations have offered direct distribution for people at risk of an opioid overdose. It was also available by prescription at many pharmacies. The new over-the-counter status is a no-brainer. There's no good reason why it shouldn't be available easily and readily. But as people who work to fight the opioid epidemic, we fear that many others may be overstating the victory here. Some seem to believe that the over-the-counter status will make naloxone more affordable, more available, and less stigmatized. But over-the-counter status will not meaningfully improve naloxone access for people who need it most. In fact, it will likely do very little besides increase pharma profits and may paradoxically make naloxone harder to access. To truly increase access to this life-saving medication, solutions need to address long-standing challenges related to medication affordability and distribution, as well as stigma related to addiction. It's unclear how over-the-counter naloxone will be priced, but there are three reasons to think it won't be much less than prescribed naloxone. A 17% increase in Emergent BioSolutions stock price after over-the-counter naloxone approval, limited pricing pressure from generics, and high name recognition among state purchasers. Together, it seems that there will only be small difference in cost, leaving this life-saving medicine still high price and out of reach for the people who need it most. Another argument for over-the-counter naloxone is that it will reduce stigma. If you can buy it without interacting with a pharmacist, the argument goes, then it's no different than buying, say, Plan B. However, the stigma and dehumanization of people who use drugs is far too entrenched to be swayed by common sense. Myths persist about Narcan parties where the presence of naloxone leads to excessive opioid consumption. Many people also falsely believe that naloxone allows people to maintain their addiction longer. Additionally, just because naloxone can be sold in more places does not mean it will be sold in more places. This claim about access belies the experience of accessing other life-saving medications. For instance, many pharmacies already don't stock buprenorphine, a Medicaid for opioid use disorder, or naloxone because they don't want, quote, those people at their places of business. Is a gas station or a Target really going to stock over-the-counter naloxone? If they do, won't it be in a locked container? Will it need prior authorization for insurance coverage, or will it be out of pocket? Some might argue pharma has a vested interest in reducing stigma because that will sell more naloxone. But that's another theory not grounded in reality. States remain major purchasers of naloxone because it's an evidence-based way to reduce mortality and widely agreed upon method by which to spend opioid settlement funds. To increase sales to individual buyers, pharma can create a massive market through fear, not stigma reduction. Now that naloxone will be available over the counter, we need more substantial efforts to reduce costs and increase access to this life-saving medication. While there is still much to be done related to insulin pricing, pressure to reduce costs for another chronic disease offers a useful roadmap for activists. The first thing would be to explore activating the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980 march-in rights, which would allow the federal government to take over naloxone manufacturing. The significant federal support in the development of Narcan and other overdose reversal products justifies this approach, can address the health and safety needs of people who use drugs, and rectify the mismatch between taxpayer investment and pharma profiteering. In parallel, states should continue to explore manufacturing generic nasal naloxone. Insulin provides a template for this as well, with California and Michigan both interested in manufacturing insulin to better control costs. It is encouraging that California already appears to be exploring manufacturing generic naloxone, but it is not clear how over-the-counter naloxone could affect that plan or if it will expand to other medications for opioid use disorder. State opioid settlement money could be used to cover the cost of state manufacturing and create legitimate pricing pressure as well as increase access. Unlike insulin, there has been little concerted outrage and effort to bring down the price of naloxone. Unless stakeholders prioritize cost control, Narcan and other overdose reversal products will continue to eat large parts of the state opioid crisis response budget, eroding funds available for other public health measures and doing little to help those who need it most. Yeah, I've reported on this before, and it looks like naloxone over-the-counter is in the $50 to $70 range. So it's not super expensive, but it's certainly not cheap for the widespread availability that's needed to do the work that it needs to do. Okay, well, sticking to the theme of big themes, let's talk about gun culture. This from the Hill. Americans bought almost 60 million guns during the pandemic. One-fifth of U.S. households purchased guns during the pandemic, a national arming that exposed more than 15 million Americans to firearms in the home for the first time, studies show. Americans purchased nearly 60 million guns between 2020 and 2022, according to an analysis by Trace, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that tracks gun violence. Yearly gun sales are running at roughly twice the level of 15 to 20 years ago. All of the new weapons may be fueling a historic surge in gun deaths, which reached record highs during the same period. It's a totally different type of gun ownership now, said John Roman, a senior fellow at the Economics, Justice, and Society Group at NORC, a research organization based at the University of Chicago. It's not a rifle stored away somewhere that you take out twice a year to go hunting. It's a handgun, probably a semi-automatic handgun, that you keep in your bedside table or in your glove compartment, or that you maybe carry around with you. The COVID-19 pandemic triggered a run on gun shops, part of a larger national spasm of panic buying that gripped the country at a moment when many Americans thought society might collapse. There was real fear and real concern about what happens to the country during a global pandemic, said Nick Cipollina, Senior Vice President of Law and Policy at Everytown for Gun Safety, a gun control nonprofit. The National Rifle Association fanned that fear, Cipollina said, by tweeting out a video of a woman holding a rifle and pushing firearms as a pandemic safety measure. You might be stockpiling up on food right now to get through this current crisis, the woman says, but if you aren't preparing to defend your property when everything goes wrong, you're really just stockpiling for somebody else. Between March 2020 and March 2022, 18% of households bought guns, according to the NORC survey. Pandemic gun sales raised the share of Americans living in armed homes to 46%, up from 32% in 2010. 5% of Americans said they bought a gun for the first time during the pandemic, which is a huge number, Roman said. These buyers were younger, they were more likely to be renters, they were more likely to be women, and they were more likely to be people of color. A scholarly study found that 7.5 million Americans became new gun owners between 2019 and 2021. Those purchasers exposed 17 million Americans to household firearms for the first time, a figure that includes 5 million children. The study found that many Americans who already own guns, nearly 20 million, bought even more. Most people say, "I bought the gun to protect myself and my family against home invasion," said Matthew Miller, professor of health sciences and epidemiology at Northeastern University and one of the report's authors. But that doesn't explain why most of the guns that were bought during this time period were bought by people who already owned guns. The pandemic accelerated a rise in gun ownership that began around 2005, the year Congress passed a law that largely shielded gun manufacturers from liability and their products are used in crimes, when their products are used in crimes. That law set off a new era of emboldened advertising by gun makers, who marketed firearms as an essential tool for defending the American home. "This is to protect yourself against your fellow humans," Roman said, with the implication being that your fellow humans are getting increasingly dangerous, which is ironic, of course, because violent crime stood at a low ebb after the turn of the millennium. Gun sales rose further with the 2008 election of former President Obama, partly from fears that the government was going to shut down gun purchases, said Eric Flieger, an associate professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School, who studies gun violence. FBI background checks for firearm sales more than doubled in a decade, from 9 million in 2005 to 23 million in 2015. 5 years later, in pandemic-scarred 2020, the Bureau conducted nearly 40 million background checks. Gun sales have retreated since then, but the FBI logged 8 million background checks through March of this year, presaging a year-end total of at least 30 million for 2023. Background checks are an imprecise measure of gun sales because they include sales of multiple weapons and concealed carry permits for guns already owned, among other complexities. Using background checks and other data, The Trace estimates that gun sales almost tripled between 2005 and 2020, from 7.8 million to 21.8 million. Firearm sales eased to about 19 million in 2021 from less than 17 million in 2022. All three figures are larger than gun sale totals for any other year in the new millennium. "Clearly, there's been a stark increase in gun purchases, and I think a lot of these folks are new," said Christine Hine, vice president of policy and programs at Brady, the gun control nonprofit. "And I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that all gun owners make sure they understand the responsibility they have to safely store these weapons, and to understand the risk that is associated with having a firearm in the home in the first place." With the nation awash in firearms, gun deaths are rising anew. Research by Flieger and colleagues found that firearm fatality rates increased by nearly half between 2004 and 2021. More Americans died from gun violence in 2020 and 2021 than in any prior year on record. Gun-related homicides and suicides totaled almost 49,000 in 2021. Shootings of children nearly doubled during the pandemic. There are no 2 years in recorded history that I'm familiar with going back to the 1980s that you see such a dramatic increase in such a short span, Fiegler said. The nation also endured a record number of mass shootings in 2021, 690 incidents of which four or more people were shot. The Gun Violence Archive tallies 646 mass shootings in 2022. The link between rising gun ownership and rising gun violence is hard to prove, yet gun ownership rates track very closely to gun fatalities, Flieger said. "If you want to know where people are dying by guns, look where the guns are." Guns are most common in the South and least prevalent in the Northeast, a 2021 Pew analysis found. Firearms sit in around half of rural homes, 40% of suburban homes, and 30% of urban dwellings, and in 40% of all American households. Researchers envision a return to an era when firearms sat in half of American homes. 5 decades of NORC surveys show a peak of gun ownership in 1977, when exactly 50% of households held guns. Nearly one-third of Americans hunted in 1977. Hunting declined over the decades, and gun ownership reached a low ebb around 2010. Estimates vary on how many guns are circulating today in the United States, but most sources suggest guns outnumber Americans. "There's enthusiasts, survivalists, collectors," Haynes said. "I think somewhere around 3% of the U.S. population, possesses more than half of the guns in the country. You're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears and maybe gear down a little bit, but talk about a health issue that's received a lot of attention in the last couple decades, autism. This from the Associated Press. Study says milder autism is far outpacing profound diagnoses. As autism diagnoses become increasingly common, health officials have wondered how many U.S. kids have relatively mild symptoms and how many have more serious symptoms, such as very low IQ and inability to speak. A first-of-its-kind study shows the rate of such profound autism is rising, though far slower than milder autism cases. Though autism has been diagnosed for at least 80 years, the new study is the first to put a number on the share of U.S. children who have the most severe version of it. It comes less than 2 years after an International Commission of Autism Experts established a definition of profound autism. Children with an IQ of 50 or less, and or kids who can't communicate through speaking. Under that definition, about a quarter of U.S. children identified as having autism by age 8 fall into the profound category. It means more than 110,000 elementary school-age children in the U.S. have profound autism. There is no blood or biological test for autism. It's identified by making judgments about a child's behavior. Traditionally, it was diagnosed only in kids with severe language difficulties, social impairments, and unusual repetitious behaviors. But the definition gradually expanded, and autism is now shorthand for a group of milder related conditions too. The researchers looked at school and medical records from 2000 to 2016 for more than 20,000 8-year-olds identified as having autism spectrum disorders. They found that the rate of profound diagnoses grew from about 3 cases per 1,000 children in 2000 to about 5 cases per 1,000 in 2016. But the rate of kids diagnosed with milder forms of autism grew from 4 per 1,000 to 14 per 1,000 over those years. Milder forms of autism were more common in boys and white kids, the researchers found. Profound autism was more common in girls than in boys. A CDC study published last month, which I reported on, found that autism overall was being diagnosed more frequently in black and Hispanic children than in white kids in the U.S. A change from previous years when white children were more likely to be diagnosed. Experts cite improved screening and services and increased awareness and advocacy. Among 8-year-olds, 1 in 36 had autism in 2020, the CDC estimates. The new research found a large racial gap in profound autism. Among black children with autism, 37% had profound autism. The same was true for about 1/3 of Hispanic kids with autism and about 1/5 of white children with autism. So this delineation of the severity is really important when you have a spectrum disease that ranges from relatively mild to profoundly disabling. And now we have a little better picture of that. Okay, well, let's close the regular reporting on this episode with a story that gets at an example of how we deal with serious illness in our healthcare system, specifically with Medicare Advantage. This from The Hill. Medicare Advantage is not an advantage for many seniors with cancer. When America's seniors enroll in Medicare, they enter the most medically vulnerable stretch of their lives. And if they are unfortunate enough to be among the 1.9 million Americans each year who hear the terrifying words, "You have cancer," it is imperative they have access to the support and care they need to survive. About 60% of cancers occur in people ages 65 and older, accounting for approximately 70% of all deaths caused by the disease. But as recently diagnosed cancer patients embark on this unwanted, unexpected care journey, what many seniors do not realize is that their Medicare Advantage plan can often put them at a disadvantage by restricting access to the care they need and deserve. Nearly half of all Medicare beneficiaries are enrolled in Medicaid Advantage plans, which equates to an estimated 29 million Americans. Unlike traditional Medicare, which allows patients to visit any hospital or any physician that accepts Medicare, Medicare Advantage beneficiaries are only able to use physicians and hospitals within their plans, and in some instances, their subcontracted medical groups, network, and service area. While Medicaid Advantage plans are ostensibly held accountable to maintain appropriate so-called network adequacy to manage the primary and specialty care needs of their enrollees, many Medicaid Advantage networks are woefully inadequate to ensure access to the latest advances most likely to help beneficiaries with cancer. This is because the industry has accepted, even encouraged, under the banner of affordability and, ironically, the catchphrase value-based care, plans to develop narrow networks. And for those developing these networks, the focus is on cost containment and not the attributes most valued by cancer patients: survival, quality of life, and additional years with friends and loved ones. While this outcome may be unintended, it is not unforeseeable. Narrow networks can successfully provide coverage for less complex illnesses where expertise is abundantly available. But to understand why Medicaid Advantage's narrow networks negatively impact cancer patients, one must understand how cancer is different from other health concerns. Cancer is not one disease, but hundreds. And the expertise needed to treat each cancer is often unavailable through the narrow networks of Medicare Advantage. With our burgeoning knowledge driven by genomics and precision medicine, the oncology field is no longer behaves as one specialty, but rather many subspecialties defined by tumor origin and specific genetic blueprint. Breakthrough advances, such as cell-based and immuno-oncology therapies, are first and sometimes only available at academic medical centers or National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer centers. But Medicaid Advantage beneficiaries are far less likely than traditional Medicare beneficiaries to receive cancer care at a teaching hospital, 23% with traditional Medicare versus only 8% with Medicare Advantage. Commission on Cancer Accredited Hospitals, Medicare 57%, Medicare Advantage 33%. Or the comprehensive cancer centers, 15% on traditional Medicare versus only 3% on Medicare Advantage. Cancer surgery statistics provide sobering evidence of the impact a lack of appropriate expertise has on outcomes. Cancer patients with Medicare Advantage who had their stomach or liver removed were 50% more, or 1.5 times more likely to die within the first month after surgery compared to their peers with traditional Medicare. And Medicare Advantage beneficiaries who had oncologic surgery on the pancreas were 2 times as likely to die within the first month. To further illustrate the importance of access to academic centers, consider your potential journey if you were diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer 10 years ago. You would be likely to die in 6 to 8 months. However, if you visited an academic medical center conducting a trial with a life-changing medication, you could have potentially expanded your life by 6 years or longer. Today, there are complex or advanced cancer cases that can only be appropriately diagnosed and safely treated at academic centers that uniquely provide cell-based therapies or newer emerging immune-based and targeted therapies. Access to these specialized centers that impact beyond immediate care needs, the clinical research that takes place in these comprehensive care centers paves the road to launching the next generation of new, more effective medications. Products with narrow network designs restrict access, adding to the burden already posed by social determinants of health. The combination of these barriers also deepens the pattern of underrepresentation in minorities in clinical trials, particularly as minority representation is greater among Medicare Advantage beneficiaries. Put another way, by accepting narrow networks that restrict beneficiaries from accessing the leading academic centers, we're broadly depriving future generations of cures and perpetuating a system that results in unacceptable disparities in health outcomes. Okay, well, this is a striking difference in cancer care between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. But I would like to remind my listeners, as I've reported before, if you look at the decrease in cancer mortality that's happened in recent decades, it's mostly related to decreases in smoking in the population. So the best opportunities we have are upstream, but certainly when you get cancer, people should get the appropriate care. And Medicare Advantage, the privatized Medicare plan, is not providing nearly as good access to that life-saving care as traditional Medicare. And to go one step further, it would be good to have health care for all, not all these different tiers, particularly when those lower tiers are much substandard care.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up we have the last regular feature of the episode, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. First up, losing ballot issues on abortion, Ohio GOP now tries to keep it off the ballot. So while they're gaining signatures to put it on a ballot, which is not going to be that hard, actually, since people are really concerned about this, the state legislatures, the Republican legislatures, are going to put on the ballot in August and create an entire special election that will cost $20 million to vote just on this, when hopefully they're hoping that turnout will be low to increase the amount for a ballot initiative from 50% to 60%, and also increase the number of counties that you need to collect data and other changes that'll make it more difficult. So I just want to remind people that democracy is a public health issue, and restricting the will of the people is not good for us in so many ways. Okay, sticking with the abortion issue, got a few more stories here. Bonus article 2, a game changer. This simple device could help fight the war on abortion rights in the U.S. This actually refers to manual uterine aspiration, which even primary care physicians could do. Relatively simple procedure. Just a little bit of hope in the fact that, as some things are getting restricted, other things might actually come in to make it easier. And this is one thing that could really help expand access. Bonus article 3. Insurers are starting to cover telehealth abortions. So as the changing landscape of abortion access continues, we're seeing that insurers are starting to upgrade their coverage to include telehealth abortion. Good news. Bonus article 4, the Dobbs decision, exacerbating U.S. health inequity. So this is a similar recounting of what I've reported on before, but this is also a focus and a reminder of the fact that back in 1976, with the Hyde Amendment, Medicaid was restricted from using federal funds, Medicaid funds, federal Medicaid funds for abortion. And that greatly limited the ability of poor women in this country to access abortions. Now, some states will use state money to fund abortions and add that to their Medicaid, but most places with the state Medicaid coverage do not cover abortions. Bonus article 5. State abortion bans may affect where Americans attend college, poll finds, even Republicans. So this is kind of my growing consideration, kind of pondering about the red-blue divide in America. And I've reported a little bit of some before, but this is a good one that shows that particularly among young people, college-age, college-bound folks, even Republicans are very much concerned with whether our state abortion bans are present where they may want to attend college. And this is actually true for men, which only are a few percentage points behind women in how concerned they are. And switching gears, but sticking to the red versus blue state, Bonus Article 6, gun violence is actually worse in red states. It's not even close. So this is nominally to address what's happening right now, where some people are saying, oh yeah, you know, all this gun violence, and they use that as a culture war issue. But of course, in the red states, it's a lot worse. And beyond that, this is a great long read. This really gets at the history and cultural changes, migration patterns, etc., that have really molded guns and gun violence debate in America. So if you're at all interested, this is a great read. Bonus Article 7, a silent crisis of men's health gets worse. So this is a good overview of course, living in a patriarchy, men get a lot of advantages, including in health systems and health research, that type of thing. But overall, all through the life cycle, from basically birth through death, men suffer more mortality, and that's from a variety of causes at all ages. So that's a good overview of that. Bonus Article 8, from swimming pools to gardening, the rich's privileged lifestyles are driving urban water crises. So this is just a specific example of what I was commenting on and referencing to early in the program about needing to change kind of our consumption patterns in order to avoid major drivers of social problems and urban water crises. Water problems around the world is just one example of that. Bonus Article 9, as the Midwest burns, Biden ignores plastic waste dangers. This is another good example of that. You know, the Biden administration wants to portray itself as, you know, environmental justice and all that. And they've done, you know, some things along those lines, certainly better than some previous administrations, most previous administrations, the last few anyways. But there, when it comes to fundamentally dealing with plastic as kind of an existential problem, is once you produce it, from production to transportation to consumption to disposal to, you know, the pollution in the environment, the Biden administration's really taking a corporate industry line on that and not really tackling the problem as a whole. And similar to that, and government having a hard time keeping up with the polluters, bonus Article 10, 18 years and counting, EPA still has no method for measuring concentrated animal feeding operations air pollution. So these CAFOs, these concentrated animal feeding operations, produce a lot of air pollution, and the EPA is still trying to figure out how exactly to measure it, let alone regulate it. Bonus Article 11, PFAS has more effect than type of diet on weight gain, says study. Now, I've seen a lot of things, I see a lot of articles of this type, but they're really associations, and there's a lot of confounders. It gets complicated as far as the design of the methods of the study, and I sort those out for you. That's part of my job here. But this actually is a very well-designed study that looks specifically at people that were, they followed their diets, had them on different types of diets. They had different levels of PFAS exposure, like measuring in their blood at the beginning. And it really showed that the amount of PFAS in the body really affects the weight gain, even more than the type of diet they were on. Yikes. So this is really important when you're talking about environmental influences. And PFAS isn't even necessarily considered the most profound of the endocrine disruptors. So, yikes. Yeah, it does not bode well for environmental pollution and effects on our bodies. Bonus Article 12. Study links air pollution, heat, carbon dioxide, and noise to reduce sleep. So, sleep is one of the pillars of health. And air pollution, heat, and carbon dioxide, and noise can all affect our sleep negatively. Sleeping in a cool, clean, and quiet environment is good for your sleep. Bonus Article 13, abundant ultra-processed food waste. So I've reported on food waste a lot before, although not too much recently. And about a third of the food that's produced worldwide is wasted. But an interesting thing is when you look at the, in recent years, with increased production of food, it's generally ultra-processed, because this is the way that our economy, food companies, make more money. There's only a certain amount of food you can cram into people, so you need to make a higher profitability per the amount of food that you have people, and making things highly processed, adding value, so to speak, economically, is what they're trying to do. But actually, when you look at the increased production that's represented by this ultra-processed food production, actually, two-thirds of that extra production in recent years or decades is actually wasted. So, yikes. That, again, talks about a systemic problem in our food system. Okay, bonus article 14. After pandemic delays, FDA still struggling to inspect foreign drug manufacturers. You know, there's been that problem with eye drops that were infecting people, and they've actually realized that the infection that was created by those eye drops is actually infecting people who never even use the eye drops, so it's reached community spread. A little bit scary. I don't know how big of an issue that is, but it's definitely an issue. But currently, after the pandemic, the FDA last year only inspected 6% of these foreign drug manufacturers compared to like 38% in earlier years. Bonus article 15. Opioid drug maker Sackler's family gave millions to an institution that advises on opioid policy. So this is very disappointing, perhaps not too surprising. But what's particularly disappointing is the lack of transparency in the institution that they were giving millions to. But money makes a difference, and people would like to think that it doesn't affect what they do, but it does. And of course, it's probably one of the reasons why they're not really transparent about it. Bonus article 16, why employers should wake up to the value of naps at work. Another sleep article. And this is really interesting because, and this was actually done in a study in India where they were looking at working. And if you look at different interventions to affect nighttime sleep, our regular time that we sleep, you know, a lot of these interventions, you can increase like the amount of sleep you get by like 27 or 28 minutes. But that doesn't actually have a profound effect on like the workers' productivity or quality of life. But if you actually give people a half hour nap at the low point in the earlier middle afternoon, it actually improves productivity a lot and worker satisfaction and their quality at work. So just a different approach to that. Bonus article 17, Lancet Psychiatry says, we are undervaluing the placebo effect. So placebo effect is a very interesting thing in a lot of particularly mental health drug research. The placebo effects tend to be larger than the drugs. And in the particular study that's talked about here at the center of this article, the procedure that was actually tested actually was worse than the placebo effect. So it probably did more harm than good. Okay, so there it is. Okay, a few articles lastly, but not leastly, on COVID. 18, WHO elevates XBBB.1.16 to variant of interest as levels rise in the U.S. and other countries. So, you know, the pandemic isn't completely over and there's still a lot of variability. We kind of lucked out in the winter season to really only have one variant, whereas last summer they just rolled out every 3 or 4 weeks being taken over by a new one. Fortunately, that slowed down, but that's still churning around. Bonus article 19 also gets at an issue that needs to be dealt with as far as COVID and other infectious diseases. Researchers detect two new SARS-CoV-2 strains on Polish mink farms, suggesting long-term circulation in animal reservoirs. So they found like 40 different mutations on these previously unidentified couple of strains of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID. And it just shows that we need to do surveillance. We need to be paying attention before we get big outbreaks, because by the time you get big outbreaks in humans, it's often too late and boom, it's out of the bag and you can't really stop it. So a boost for surveillance is needed. Last article. Bonus article 20, the heightened risk of autoimmune diseases after COVID. So this is a good, not just an overview, this is a very detailed examination of the many autoimmune diseases that that rise after getting COVID. And we're talking about like a 28 to 40% increase in these autoimmune diseases. So that's not insignificant. So one of the many hits that COVID takes on our system. You can view this and all the articles that I report on in this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.